we're talking about than what I'd like to talk about. Am I on, Nick? Try that. It's good. All right. Okay, I appreciate the opening, Joseph, and the songs that were picked. I like that we can be together. Thank God for that. Smaller group, but good to be here. Let's pray. Our Father, we come to you again. We have numerous times this morning, but we come again asking your presence here, that you would be with us, that you would speak to us, that you would minister to your people, your children. Help us to see our eternal home, your eternal home, that we can come there and live with you forever, and that you've promised that you've sent your Son Jesus to make a way, to show the way, to make the way. Thank you that he is the way and that we can follow him, that he's our shepherd and guide, and also our judge, but also our friend, as your word declares it. Thank you for that, that we've come to walk with you and know you. Pray that this would be an encouraging time. Help us to see the right things. We just commit ourselves into your care. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. I will be continuing with Hebrews 12. If you have a Bible, go there, please. Hebrews 12. It's easier to see what I'm talking about. I'll do a quick recap of we did the first half of chapter 12 last time, and I'll be doing the second half, but I'd like to do a quick recap. Okay, before I do that, I need some markers. Okay, I hope what I'm about to share goes together and doesn't distract from what has been said and what I want to say. But I've been thinking about assuming Apostle Paul wrote this epistle. It says at the end it was written to the Hebrews from Italy by Timothy. And being that he was together with Paul and has Paul's style, we're assuming it's Paul that wrote it. So when I say Paul, it's assumption, but based on as good information as we have. So when Paul wrote this, and when Jesus walked, I just want to say a few things before I go into the message here in 5 minutes, that the things that we face on a daily basis with the times that we're in, politics are not new, and pressure from authorities are not new. It's always been. Paul had it. Jesus had it. Paul and Jesus walked on different times, close together, but different, and they would have had different scenarios around them. Paul was in Rome and Judea, but his exterior or his external world affected his life, but you find very little of it here. Sometimes it gives practical things of how he went before the court, but there's not much in here considering all that he could have put in, considering who Nero was and the other rulers of Rome and how corrupt it was and how corrupt society was. People say that if you go to that time in those areas where they were, where Paul journeyed through and where he was for a time, that some of the things, the tours that they go with, I think John D. might have said it, the tours that they take through those times now, some of the statues and some of the imagery is so foul, I'll say it that way, that it's adults only in certain sections of the tour. It was very bad. I don't want to say much more about it. But Paul walked through that. He saw it. He lived there. He got that pressure. So I'd like to briefly share on something that I've been thinking about for the last few weeks. And again, hopefully it goes together. But how many of you have ever been in a sailboat? Anybody? Okay, so a few. But how many know the concept of sailing? Like if people start off from England and they get to America, right? You would think that if the continent is here and America is here, you need a wind blowing this way, right? Pretty safe when the ship goes across the sea and docks in New York over here. You need a wind going that way. However, we know that the wind goes all over, and yet the ship will start off here and end up there. And on the return voyage, we're going back with the wind being everywhere. But they do that all the time. And it's a very simple concept for, if I can just briefly explain it and make a point about it, but you would think that a boat powered by wind should only be able to go, if the wind is coming from the north, you would think that a boat should only be able to go as far as degrees go this way, because the wind will eventually just, the boat has no power. If the sail is catching wind, it can only go away from the wind at a slight angle, and that's all we can do. And once you're over on the shore and pushed up on the sand, you kind of hope and pray the wind goes back the other way so you can go back home to your truck and get the boat back home, right? Or do you just wait on the sand or carry it around the lake shore, drag the boat around? So how does that work, that a boat can sail almost in any direction? What do they do? So if the wind comes from here, north, a boat can sail in all of this area. In fact, something like that. Hopefully we can see that. So a boat is actually completely fine with sailing. In some cases, it's faster sailing this way than it is straight that way, oddly enough. But a boat can easily do all of this. What it cannot do is go straight into the wind, but all the rest is perfectly fine. So how that works, just very briefly, is if you would picture a bar of soap that is wedge-shaped like this. Okay, so this is soap. Your fingers are soapy. We've all had soap in our hand in the shower. When you squeeze it a bit, it shoots to the top of the shower. And you pick it up, and it scoots away again, right? So if you picture a bar of soap, it's very slippery. And as you squeeze this, it goes up, right? Right? Okay. So that's the idea that we're talking about, but I'll leave this here. So as you would picture this way, this is now a track. Maybe a car or something is on this track. And if you would picture the same wedge of soap here, and the wind is coming this way, if I push up here and this is my soap, this track is not letting this thing move this way, okay? The soap is fixed on the track. It needs to go either this way or this way, and that's what the rudder does. It guides your boat. Soap, the rudder is here, steering you one way. So the rudder is not letting it turn, but the wind is pushing this way, backwards, right? So you have essentially a V, right? And as you squeeze your soap, the soap will always go up. So even if I take the soap and I push down, if I push this way with one hand and I push this way with that hand, I'm pushing straight down here, right, on the soap, and the soap is going up, right? It'll scoot in the air even though I'm pushing down, right? We get that? So we push this way, we push that way. It's still, even though we're pushing directly this way, the soap flies up. And it's the same way with a boat. So as the wind comes and pushes, your sail is like this, catching the wind, because the sail swivels in any direction you want. It's on a pivot right here. So the sail moves like this and catches the wind. And because your rudder is pushing up, away from it, you're creating a wedge, and the boat moves forward like your soap would. So I don't know if that makes sense, but the reason I say that is as you look at what Jesus went through and what Paul was looking at on a daily basis, and you find very little of politics in there. In fact, the more that they were pressed, the more that they were pressed, the more spiritually awake and alive they were. And I think that applies to anybody that we read as far as martyrdom goes. If you read Martyr's Mirror, where teenagers testified and would not turn, their eyes became sharper and clearer as they were pressed a certain way. But on the other hand, that same boat, and I had an experience this summer, if the wind is coming this way, and the harder the wind is, the worse it is. The faster the wind is, the faster your boat goes, and it's more fun. But on the flip side, if you don't take care, if you don't watch, if this is your sail, and maybe your boat's like this, not an artist. If this is your sail, the wind is like this way, it's catching your sail broadside, and this your rudder, you're steering, and you're doing well. It's a good angle to be at. The boat is going rapidly this way because it's actually a fast way to travel with that angle. But if you're not careful, if the wind changes a little bit, if the wind comes at you a little bit this way and your sail is too steep, can you guess what happens? Caleb is grinning. That's probably the scariest experience of his life. Caleb and I almost flipped the sailboat this summer. So if the sail is this way and the wind is coming that way, if you're not taking care, the boat flips over almost instantly, and there is no backtracking usually. So they are equipped with ways of riding it, but it's very, very scary, and it's very, very quick. So from going at a good clip, the wind is blowing. One of the oddest things I've experienced is the wind blowing at my face at an angle, and the boat is going into it. It's a weird experience to know that you're being pushed that way by a wind coming at your face. You feel it, but you're going into it. And from that, when you turn around, because you need to tack, you go at angles to the wind. So as you turn around at a certain point, you're square against the wind on the side. The wind is pushing you. And if you're not careful to not stay here, you are flipping. You're going sideways. And if you're in the middle of the lake on a flipped sailboat, that sail is 20-some feet high usually. It goes into the water, and it's like a wet, if you think of a rag in your sink, how quickly, heavily, how heavy it gets and how waterlogged it is. That sail is cloth, and it's 20 feet long, and it's laying in the water. It's very heavy, and your boom is heavy. It goes under, and it's pointing straight down in some most cases. And it's very, very quick. So the reason I say that is what you do with the wind is you can sail with the wind, but if you're not careful, you can die very quickly, or at least be stranded in the middle of a lake with an upturned boat. So it's very sobering. And as we look at what these men did, keeping that in mind, and keeping in mind what Paul is talking about, I will say that we, in our time, can work with what we're given as far as pressure goes. And when I say pressure, I'm talking political things that come our way. We need to remember they always were. We grew up in a very mild time as far as government pressure and things like that. But it wasn't always so, and it's not always going to be that way. I think we can safely assume that. And whether people are playing God and trying to rewrite society, or whether they're doing their very best with the information they've given, we don't know that, honestly. We have leanings, what we think might be, and we have clues, but this might be true. Some guy has a story that's very true. This one has another one that looks true, but it's total made-up junk. It's hard to know what's going on, is what I'm saying. But as that pressure comes, what we do with it can drive you home, as Joseph was saying, and as this talks about here, as you guide and work with what's happening, work with the pressure the right way, then it's okay. However, it could easily be, and I think it is happening to some, and hopefully not to us, that we continue through, keep our eyes and our vision of where we need to be going, and whatever happens, we work with it, and it brings us closer to God and closer to our heavenly home. I just want to leave that backdrop out there. With the realization that if you're not careful, if the pressure comes to a certain way and you're not dealing with it properly, it might flip you right over. So that's the sobering part, and it's absolutely real. And as we go through this, there are strong warnings here. The last time we talked about this, there was a fair bit about discipline. And the point that Paul makes here is that discipline is a good thing for the reason of somebody's looking out for us and looking at the harm that can come from a situation and applying discipline that we don't continue in those things. And it's a good and loving thing to do. So I'm going to quick recap chapter 12. Where do I start? So in chapter 12, 1, it says, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. Let us run the race with patience. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us." And I appreciate his analogy, and I think last time I shared, I didn't say this, but running a race with patience, and the Bible, our life on earth is also talked as of a walk with God. So if you sought God last week and you were really, really close to God last week, that doesn't mean that you will this week, and it doesn't mean that you will in the future. But on the flip side, if we have not last week, we can this week, and we can tomorrow. I believe it's a daily choice that we continually walk with God so that when he comes that we're ready and we have been alive and active and watching for him and walking with him. It's not automatic. It's not one time we're good, glorious Christians and we just park there. That's not the case. Wherefore, seeing we're compassed about, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. Let us run with patience, endurance, continuing on. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. So running with patience, it's a race. We're always moving. There's endurance. There's a goal. We're not stopping. It's long term. There's the destination. There are no detours. It's not a burst. And there is a reward. So just quickly running through that. And then looking unto Jesus, I think that's the key. That's where the encouragement is. That's where the strength is. We're looking at his relationship with his Father. Read some things last time. His manner of dealing with the people. His priorities on his time on earth, in the same earth that we're on. What he talked about. What did he say? Where were his eyes looking? And it says, for the joy that was set before him. And I've been listening to the crucifixion, his trial. And it's awful to listen to if you stop and think about what happened. It's truly awful to listen to. The passages and to read that. But it says here, for the joy that was set before him, he endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. And we can take courage in that too. So we're not, I don't think we'll enjoy if things get bad, but we're looking beyond it to home. We have to have that perspective. And again, what we do with the pressure is basically up to us. We can guide our vision Godward, home to the kingdom that cannot be moved, as it'll talk about in a bit, or we can be just focused on here and lose sight and be swamped. It talked about discipline, chastisement. So there's three things that can happen in life. There's trouble, things that just happen because we're in a fallen world. There's persecution, things that are directly resulting our faith, what we believe, and things that are a result of that. And then there's discipline, when we get corrected because of repeated or known disobedience, like our children or like we do. So there's trouble, stuff that happens, dead batteries on the way to church. We had that a while back. I don't know, a cordless tool falling from a roof and smashing. It just happens. We deal with it. There's persecution, things that happen because specifically we're believers. And then there's discipline when we get corrected because of repeated or known disobedience. So that concept was talked about last time a fair bit, and that it's a loving thing, it's a good thing. And I think I gave the illustration last time. If you're driving on a trip with a vehicle, you plan for it for a year, you saved up, there's things you can get away with. If your seats are worn out, you've got springs poking through, if your windshield's cracked, your mirrors are off. Like, there's a way that a vehicle's supposed to be when you go on a trip and a way it's not supposed to be, and you can get away with certain things. If your windshield is out, you're limited on your speed. If you mistakenly hit your windshield wiper cleaner, it's in your face. I mean, there's things that are just not nice. And there's things that you can get away with, but there's also things you cannot get away with. This cannot happen. So there's maturity and growing, but there's also no-go things. And as in the car illustration, you can't put water in the oil. You can't run without tires. There are certain things that just can't be. And I think that's where discipline comes in. When there's things happening that we're not taking seriously, and God knows it's a problem, and he deals with something in our life and says, stop, deal with this. So life has its consequences at work to teach us. If you're a brat, you'll probably not have friends. If you don't work, you don't eat. If you don't study, you don't pass the test. Those things are just life. But there's things that are no-go. You can't do that. So a toddler, if he touches the books, we can work with that. If he's going toward a fireplace, that's 500 degrees. There's different measures we take, and that can't happen. And the parent decides that, not the child. The child doesn't decide this is a big deal, this is not. The one who knows looks out. So it's for their good. So things like a violent child can become a murderous adult. There are certain things that we take very seriously, and we discipline accordingly in love. And I said last time that I think it's a good prayer to pray to God to father me, be my father. Love equals discipline. And again, the question can be asked, does that mean that God spanks me all day? Not at all. That's not the point. No. A father loves and encourages where needed, and he protects from what needs to be protected when he sees it fit and wise, and that's a good thing. And especially if it's God that we're talking about. God is all-wise, all-knowing. He knows us. He knows the circumstances. He knows the future. and thanks be to God for heaven's wisdom, because he looks out for us. So it's a loving thing when we get disciplined. So I talked about the aspect of sailing here and our choices and where we look. So just moving on to 12:12, it says, "Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees." This is the context of receiving discipline. Don't be discouraged. Don't have a pity party. Be encouraged. Lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. Make straight paths for your feet. Let that which is lame be turned out of the way. Let it rather be healed. It's kind of odd wording there. But I'd like to go back to, I think it's Isaiah 35. I don't know if I wrote it down, but if you have your Bible, go to Isaiah 35. It is a beautiful passage. Sorry, I thought I wrote it down. I think it's Isaiah 35. It's the way of holiness. And I thought I had a marker, and I don't. Okay, Isaiah 35, I'd like to read that. The wilderness, this is my Bible has the heading of the joyful flourishing of Christ's kingdom, and where it's getting its context from is the end of it. And a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness, but the unclean shall not pass over it, and shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, they shall not err therein. So anybody can walk there, the simple. Obey God, and you can walk in the ways of God, who is all wise. So Isaiah 35. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. And the glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, and the excellency of Carmel and Sharon shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. Strengthen ye the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, and the lame man shall leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water, and the habitation of dragons, where each lay shall be grass and reeds and rushes. And a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness, and uncleanness shall not pass over it, and it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools shall not err therein. And I don't think it's talking about fools as in somebody that goes against God, that kind of fool. I think it's talking a simple person. You don't have to be educated for 20, 65 years to be able to walk in good ways before God. A simple person can do it by obeying God. No lion shall go there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon, and it shall be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransom of the Lord shall return, and come to Zion with songs, and everlasting joy upon their heads, and they shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So let's keep that in mind. And the reason I read the whole thing is it's taking, in Hebrews 12, it's taking a few sections here. In 35:3, strengthen ye the weak hands, confirm the feeble hands. It's talking about the way of holiness in verse 8. And then in verse 10, the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs. Keep that in mind. They come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. Keep that in mind for when we get there in Hebrews 12. How the ransomed are coming to Zion as the contrast is laid out. So that's a beautiful imagery. But this is where it's from. So in verse, back to chapter 12, Hebrews 12. Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, make straight paths for your feet, lest that which be lame, its lame be turned out of the way, let it rather be healed. If I can paraphrase, we know maybe the watch your thoughts, for they become, how does that go? I don't remember. So basically what we think about becomes part of us, and once it's part of us, we walk it out. So our thoughts can become literally who we are, that concept. But as we choose how we walk, going back to the illustration here, as we choose our, where we put priorities, how we walk, make straight paths for your feet. Walk where you're supposed to be walking, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, lest that which is lame, if you're walking where you're not supposed to be walking, you can be lame or get injured, I'll say it that way. And once you're injured, it's easy to be gotten off the path that you're supposed to be on. Can I paraphrase that way? So watch where you're walking that you do not get injured, because once you're injured, you can get out of the way that you're supposed to be on, but rather let it be healed. But that starts with choosing how you're walking, make straight paths for your feet. Do we see that concept? It's very, what's the word, narrow. There, you can't just do what you want. It's very specific. So as we think of the sailing illustration, it's very careful how you have your sail angle and your rudder angle. It's very critical, because if you do it wrong, for one, you can just straight stall out. If you go straight into the wind, you park. And once your sailboat is parked, it's stalling out. It's hard to get moving again. You have to flip everything around with an oar, basically, to get the thing moving again. With the wind, you have to go the wrong way. And once you're moving, you flip it around and go into the wind again, because you can't start off into the wind. That's once you're moving, you flip the boat around and then you head into the wind. So once you stall out, it's a long procedure. And with that, you're parked and you can flip because you're not moving. You don't have maneuverability. Once you're moving, it's no problem. You can do whatever you want. But getting going is tough. And the other thing is, if you're sideways, you're not careful, and the wind comes up and catches you, you flip over again almost instantly. It's something to be watched for. However, contrasted with, he who has the mastery, no, I won't say that either. I don't remember how it goes. Beautiful quote, but I didn't prepare. So careful how you walk. So going back to the verse here, make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Be careful how you walk. So don't bring hurt to yourself, rather be healed. Don't make choices that can cripple you. Be careful with the wind. Follow peace with all men. There's so much more I can say about all of this, but for sake of time, I have to keep moving. So I don't consider it finished. I'm just making comments on some of these things. I think somebody could preach a whole message on 3-4 verses. There's so much in there, especially this one, verse 13, what can be applied and all that, but I have to keep going. So again, I don't consider it finished or exhausted. It's just I'm touching on it to make the points. So follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. And Jesus, to quote him directly, what did he say? The pure in heart shall see God. Jesus' words and now Paul's words, follow peace with all men and holiness without which no man shall see the Lord. So I listened to something about John Dee the other day. It was one of his older series, I think, and he talked about being a peacemaker, going through the Beatitudes, or a peace lover. And he was saying that a peacemaker engages in situations that are uncomfortable to bring peace to them. You work through issues, you talk about it, you push through it, you process things to make peace, to have a peaceful solution. A peace lover can often just avoid situations to just not have conflict, and you just, I don't want to talk about it, and you skirt around it, leaving the issue there. It's not at peace, you just didn't deal with it. So being a peace lover and avoiding conflict isn't necessarily what he's talking about. When it says follow peace with all men, that is, I think it's an action, doing whatever we can to be at peace with people. Maybe it's going up to somebody and saying, I'm sorry, I did so-and-so. I think you might be offended at me. Is there something I can do? Or somebody's mad at you and you did something wrong, your attitude is not to push back, but I'm sorry, how can I do that better? How can we fix this? What can I do? just follow peace with all men, whatever that means for whatever situation. It's a broad thing. And holiness without no man, which no man shall see the Lord. And then there's some very serious things that come up here. So in verse 15, looking diligently, and I think this is looking to ourselves, and it's also looking out for our brothers and sisters. So I think it's a two-way thing here. We help each other with these things, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God. So if we see somebody's life with God getting lean or them being distracted, we don't want them to fail the grace of God. We want them to be walking in paths that are straight for their feet and not get killed or injured in where they're going. And again, there's many applications we can make there, but I won't. So looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest the grace of God is one. Two, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you. And the thing with the root is, see where I have that here. So a root will be a few things. It'll be underground, right? We won't necessarily see it. There's above ground results for underground sources. So it's not something I think that's very showy. If somebody has a root of bitterness, I think it's carefully stated that way. So it's underground trouble that makes above ground, or underground sources that make above ground results that are bad. And it says many be defiled. So a root might be hard to see, and I think it'll be harder to see for the person who has the root. I hope that our relationships are such that we can help each other, that somebody, if I have something in my life that I'm not moving past, that I'm not forgiving, that I have bitterness towards, that somebody can love me enough to come up to me and say, are we sure that there's no root of bitterness here? That somebody from the outside with clear view can help me with that. I think that's what it's talking about. Because it's something that can spring up and trouble and defile many. And I've seen cases where that happens. It's often really, really hard to deal with once it's at that point. Because once it's there, it's a long way down a wrong road. So are we clear and free with all men? So following peace, watching for a root of bitterness, watching that no one fails in the grace of God. Moving on, another point, lest there be any fornicator to take seriously what God takes seriously. I think we talked about some of that previously. To take seriously what God calls a serious issue. So we're not taking cues from our culture. We don't take cues from our surroundings or what is normal in society. God is the standard. And when God puts the standard where he puts it, he knows. God knows. And in Hebrews 11, we had men and women that aligned themselves to God's reality, and they came out victorious and true instead of what the people saw with their eyes around them. So if people around us make things normal, we can't say that's normal, that's okay. We have to take it as serious as God takes it for it to come out right. or profane person. Profane is also a strong word. It's corrupting, disrespectful, irreverent. So there's many different shadings to that word. not sacred, disrespectful, irreverent, corrupting. So those are obviously things that we would be wanting to help each other out. If there's anything that shows up like that, we'd obviously want to be taking it very seriously. As Esau, for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. And what he did, we look back and we can be hard on him, but he made a short-term decision, short-term pleasure for long-term trouble. He traded that off. Short-sightedness, to give a short gain for long-term trouble, is what he did. And if we don't look to God rightly, I think it's a danger that we can find ourselves in. For you know that how afterwards he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected. He found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. So Isaac blessed Jacob, there was no plan B. He wanted it. Like, he saw clearly at the end what he did. But at a certain point, it's too late. There's no turning back from it. And so just keep these things in backdrop, the things that God takes seriously, and then moving on. For ye are not come unto the mount that might be touched. So going back to Genesis, go back there if you have a Bible as well. It's Genesis 20, I think. Genesis 20. I didn't realize how long of a story it was when Moses went up. I read it yesterday evening. And there's the Ten Commandments given in chapter 20, I think it is. Oh, I'm thinking Exodus, sorry. Wrong book. So Exodus 20, I think it is, where the Ten Commandments, and then they're listed again in 32. So yeah, it starts off in chapter 19. Let me read that just for backdrop to Hebrews 12, because it's taking it directly out of here. And Moses went up unto God, I'm in chapter 19, verse 3 in Exodus. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. So remember, the Egyptians, that was a really, really big thing. Drowning an army, standing the water up. It was deliverance. It was direct God intervention. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then shall you be, ye shall be a peculiar people unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. So God states that. And you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. So skipping forward, he told them to get ready, what they should do. Verse 11, and be ready against the third day, for the third day the Lord will come down in the sight of all the people upon Mount Sinai. And thou shalt set bounds unto the people round about, saying, take heed to yourself that ye go not up into the mount, or touch the border of it. Whosoever toucheth the mount shall surely be put to death. There shall not a hand touch it, though he surely shall be stoned or shot through. Whether it be beast or man, he shall not live. When the trumpet soundeth long, they shall come up to the mount. And again, up to it, not touching it. They even had him put up a fence that they were very, 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 very sure, do not touch the mountain. More instruction. And it came to pass on the third day in verse 16 in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount. I remember thunderstorms as a boy. We'd go out in the backyard. Before the rain came, you'd be out in a blanket in the backyard and you watch the thunder and the clouds rolling in. And some of it you could feel if you were close enough. It was a movement in your chest as that sound rolled over you. And just the awesome power. And maybe I was younger, more impressionable, but I can't forget that feeling of that thunder and the lightning and the power and the awe of it. So in the morning there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of the trumpet. I don't know if it's an actual trumpet sound or just the biggest sound that he knew at the time. Revelation does that too. Maybe that was the biggest, loudest noise they had. So he's saying trumpet. Maybe it was a trumpet. I don't know. Exceeding loud, so that all the people in the camp trembled. So lightning, thunder. And further on, there's and a thick cloud. Later on, it says smoke. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God. And they stood at the nether part of the mountain. So they stood on the bottom. And Mount Sinai was altogether a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace. So it's not just an idle drifting. It's a smoke that's going up like a black chimney. And the whole mount quaked greatly. When the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake. And God answered him by a voice. So amidst of this awesome show of power, Moses spoke, and God answered him by a voice. And the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mount, and the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mount, and Moses went up. We're doing a study as young people. Moses, the friend of God, part of it. And some of these things, when I read them, it's like, who was this man? Who is Moses? That everyone else later on, they panic. But Moses went into that thing. And I can't imagine. I guess he knew God and he followed his voice. I'll say it that way. And the Lord came down upon the Mount Sinai on top of the mount, and the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mount, and Moses went up. And the Lord said unto Moses, Go down, charge the people, lest they break through unto the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. So God, in this exchange here, says, Go down. Moses says, they're fine. We have fences up, I think. And then he says, God says, Go down, make it happen. And then they got given the Ten Commandments, till verse 17. I'll skip forward, where God wrote that. In the verse 18, pick up here again, verse 19, 18. And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet. It must have been awful. And the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed. That means they ran off and stood afar off. So they were terrified and panicked and fled, basically. And they said unto Moses, Speak thou with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die. So Moses, you talk to us. We cannot handle this. And Moses said unto the people, Fear not, for God is who has come to prove you. And that is his fear may be before your faces, that you sin not. And the people stood afar off. They stayed far off. They did not draw near. Moses drew near into the thick darkness where God was. And then he gives them commands. And then there's chapters and chapters and chapters of command, of things where God told Moses how it's going to be, the tabernacle offering sacrifices, until chapter 32. He went up again. And in chapter 32, so this is 21, and in 32, Moses comes down again. When the people saw that Moses was delayed, we have the instance where the calf. So that's the next thing after all of these chapters of instruction. He was up there for 40 days and nights. They got tired and had Aaron make a calf. So that's kind of the setting. So from this terror, a smoking, shaking mountain with smoke going up like a furnace and fire and thunder and lightning, 40 days and nights afterwards, the people saw that Moses was delayed to come out of the mount. They gathered themselves together to Aaron and said unto them, Let us make gods which shall go before us. Which shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what has become of him. Isn't that so anticlimactic? Just like thud. From being, God said to them, before all of this, he said, You will be unto me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. That's the plan. He showed them his power. He remembers what we did to the Egyptians. He gives them the instructions. After 40 days, we're all tired of this program. Moses or Aaron, make a calf. This is tiresome. We don't know where he went, and it's all over. So from there to there, so keeping that story in mind, that's what he's referring to. For they, and he's referring directly back to that. For you are, he's, okay, back to Hebrews 12, he's saying, take it seriously because you are not coming to the mount that might be touched. This is not what we're dealing with here. And burned with fire, nor unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet, and the voice of words, which voice that they heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them anymore. They were so terrified of it, they said, Let God not speak us anymore. Moses speak to us. They were so terrified by it, for they could not endure that which was commanded. And if so as much as a beast touched the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through the dart. So going back to that time, and so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly quake in fear. So if that's the earthly counterpart, he's saying, that's not what you're dealing with. That's doable, he's saying. You're dealing with something very different than the New Testament in this new time. Here's what you're looking at. But ye are come unto Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God, the same one. He's not changed from that, but it's just a different setting. It's not Mount Sinai. This is where he lives. You are come unto Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable, uncountable. If you think of an uncountable number, we can picture sand because it's small. You can have a handful and barely count it. But angels are different. To have uncountable angels, that's not a handful of sand that you stir. This is, I would say, miles of angels serving him. The heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn which are written in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. So I underlined here just men, and it can mean only men or righteous or just men. Made perfect. They were human beings, but they attained righteousness before God. And Jesus, this is also who we're coming to. Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, the one that set this all up. It's his covenant, his contract, covenant is a contract. And to the blood of the sprinkling that speaketh of better things than that of Abel. So not a blood sacrifice of goats, but of Jesus Christ himself. So this is what you're dealing with. And I'd like to go to Revelations again, just to give that backdrop. And I think it's Revelation 21, if I remember correctly. So again, if you have a Bible, go there. And I do like reading this. I have it numerous times. I will again. Chapter 21, read a few verses here. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So it talked in Hebrews 12 of the New Jerusalem that we're going to be approaching. And I heard a great voice of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. Think of the imagery. It's going back to Exodus. The tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them. And they shall be his people. Do you see the imagery, what he's doing, going back to Exodus, what we read before, when God gave his heart, you shall be a peculiar people. And he says later on, I will be their God. So he's taking this and putting it right over here. And I heard a great voice of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. And for me, that's a tinglingly scary, exciting thought, because he didn't change from Mount Sinai. He's still that. You can make mountains shake and smoke, and his voice is a trumpet so that normal men flee from it. That's him. And he will dwell with them. They shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. But he's not vengeful and wrathful and wiping them out with a wave by the millions. It says, God shall wipe away all the tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, write, for these words are faithful. Skipping forward, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. And then he contrasts it here. And these are realities before God. We have to take seriously what God takes seriously. Going back to chapter 12, if we have things in our life that God is chastening, we can thank God that he does that, because he sees what he sees. We don't. We're like a child. We want to touch a bookshelf. We want to touch a stove. There's a big difference. And to a child, he doesn't get that. God does. And this is the contrast. But the fearful, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, the whoremongers, the sorcerers, the idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake of fire, with burnished with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So it's not a free-for-all. And when he uses language like this, make straight paths for your feet. Walk where you're supposed to be walking, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way. You can make a choice today, like Esau, for short-term pleasure, have eternal consequences. Make straight paths for your feet. Lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. To not be profane, to not be a fornicator, to not have bitterness. Think of what Jesus did on the cross to the people that crucified him. Father, forgive them, for they know not what to do. There is no bitterness there. God is love. God is forgiveness. God is grace. So when we harbor bitterness, it is completely against what God did. It is a very serious thing. It is anti-God. It is the devil is bitter. The devil is vengeful. God is love, forgiveness. And it's something that, again, looking diligently, let's look that we can help each other with these things, that we not be like Esau for short-term pleasure, give up such tremendous blessing. I could read, I think I will here. Go Revelation 21 again, talking of the city that we're approaching. having the glory of God, and her light was like unto the stone, most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. And a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, and at the gate 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of 12 tribes of the children of Israel. And on the east 3 gates, and on the north 3 gates, and on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. So 12 gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations. So our houses have one foundation. This city has 12. And in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he that talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city and the gates thereof. And the city lieth foursquare, it was a square, and the length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with the reed 12,000 furlongs. Somebody sent me a picture a while back of how big this would actually be. They had it superimposed over a map of the U.S. And I think it was a few states, but I don't quite remember. I'd have to look it up. It's really, really, really big. So the length and breadth and height of it are equal. And he measured the wall thereof in 144 cubits according to the measure of a man, that is, of the angel. Then it goes into how it looked, precious stone. And the building of the wall was of jasper, and the city was of pure gold, like unto clear glass. And the foundation of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalced, Tony, I don't know what that is, the fourth an emerald, the fifth sardonyx, and the sixth sardius, and the seventh chrysolite, and the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth, I don't know what any of these are. Curious to look it up and see what shades they have and how they go together. Verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 pearls, and every several gate was one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, as it were transparent glass. And I saw no temple there, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. And the city had no need of the sun, neither the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it. And by the gates of it, and the gate of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it, and there shall in no wise enter into anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination or maketh a lie, and they which are written, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life. So very, very sobering. And in a very brief time, our life is done. I mean, we have such a short time here. I think I said it last time, maybe to my family or here, but if you think of how old the people lived, you think of Enoch, Adam, if you look at their lifespan, even Noah, they lived to be, let's say, 950. If you were to take five of them, so one lives to be 950, he has the child towards that end of his life. His child lives. He would have been at the flood in two generations. If you take two more people, like dad, no, great-grandfather, grandfather, father, son, if you would take that lifespan, you are already at the cross with four people. That's not long. And if you take two more, grandchild or great-grandchild and great-great-grandchild, you're today. So you could theoretically, with six people with that lifespan, reach here today from creation. So this is not a long millions of stuff thing. It's a short time that God created the earth. 6,000 years is not long. There's actually surprisingly few generations if you take back how many there are, if you count them. Like, it looks uncountable. But it's technically not a long time at all. And if you think of how short our life is, I think 41. I well remember when I was 3, younger than Tobias, I remember being with my mom and where we went. And I don't feel a whole lot, like how I felt then and how I looked at the world and how I thought isn't too much different than now. I'm wiser. I'm maybe a little bit more cynical as far as the wonder in a child. But I feel like I felt then. I remember how I felt. I remember how I thought. I remember how things affected me. And it's been almost 40 years since stuff I can remember from 3 years old. But what I'm saying is that time went so quickly. And if I do that again, I'm 80, and most people live to there or about thereabouts. So in a very short time, again, we've heard this many, many times, but in a very short time, we move to what I read here. To approaching this city that it talks about in in Hebrews 12. So just to move forward through that, let's keep those things in mind. And as I said with the illustration of sailing, whatever pressures we get, make sure they push us in the right way and our focus is in the right place. And remember, they had more pressure than we, I think, ever will. So what Paul looked at, what Paul faced, they had serious Christian persecution. So I'm not minimizing what we have, by the way. I think it's serious, but I'm just saying to keep the focus right and not to get distracted by things that can harm us and forget about eternal things that will ultimately, could ultimately be far, far, far worse. So see that you refuse not him that speaketh, for if they escaped not to refuse him that spake on earth, going back to Mount Sinai, how much more shall we not we escape if we return away from him that speaketh from heaven? So Hebrews starts off with this. God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, had in these last days spoken to us by his Son. So to keep that there, and then look what Jesus did, look how he was, look at the life he lived, Matthew 5, 6, 7, the Gospels, that is who he was, that is what he wanted. Those things are what they are. He laid them out. That is a kingdom which cannot be moved going forward here. So he speaks from heaven, but whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And I think this is tied in with discipline. So if we're building on the wrong thing, verse 27 here says, in this word, oh, he's saying, I will yet once more, I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word yet once more signifieth the removing of those things which are shaken. So if there's things in our life that we're building on or putting pressure or emphasis on, and it's wrong, and it just won't work out, God, I think, on purpose, shakes it. Now, whether it might be good things, but if it's not what we should be building on, what we should be looking at, what we should be counting on, it says here, from what I can read, that God will on purpose move those things. Move the rug under our feet, check the stability. And if it's always Christ and his kingdom and his work, then we're fine. But if we find our whole world shaken, maybe we're looking at the wrong thing, and God is doing that on purpose. And this word, once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. And what? If we look at Jesus' life, he was shaken. If you think of his friends, his environment, his security, his life, it was all shaken. But the thing that he looked at remained. Wherefore, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace. So that is where he's going to. Wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved. So that kingdom, our home, as Joseph shared, our home is waiting for us. We are preparing for it. We're living like that. We're believing and trusting God in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, that we look to the right places. So read it again. And this word yet once more signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of those things that are made. We don't want to be building or looking at things that are made. That those things which cannot be shaken may remain. So the true things will stay. They should be built upon. They should be planned for. Wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably. And I'll say it this way. How do we serve God? Then we look at who he was. It was peaceable. He was peaceable. He was humble. He was just. He was honest. He was loving. He was patient. He was honorable. He lived simply, Christ-like. And to somebody hearing me, that can be so silly or trite. But if you plan on what God plans on and walk how Jesus walked and put the emphasis where he put it, that's the safest way to go. So wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence, with respect, and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. He's not to be trifled with. We don't stand up against him. We don't ignore him. We don't underestimate him. We don't disrespect him. We take him seriously like this creation needs to. So in closing, I'd just like to read a song, which I have before, but I won't do again. just to put that out. So we've talked to the aspect of discipline, the aspect of the sobriety of it, of having things in our life that shouldn't be there, to take seriously those things where, or seriously how we walk, to listen to Jesus, to look to the kingdom which cannot be moved, lest those things around us be shaken. I'd like to read a song in closing in light of that. For our God is a consuming fire. To combine those things, I think the song, O Thou in Whose Presence, does it well. I'd like to read that. John D. has a few verses here, but there's others that I like more, so I'll read others as well. O Thou in Whose Presence, thinking of Moses going into the cloud when others ran away, think of what he did. By all estimates, there were hundreds of thousands or millions of people there at the time, and they were all terrified. They removed and ran away. And Moses went to God. O Thou in Whose Presence my soul takes delight, on whom in affliction I call. He's my comfort by day and my song in the night. Usually people are afraid in the night. This is a song in the night. My hope, my salvation, my all. Where dost thou, dear shepherd, resort with thy sheep to feed them in pastures of love? Why in the valley of death should I weep, or alone in the wilderness rove? Why should I wander, an alien from thee, or cry in the desert for bread? Thy foes will rejoice when my sorrow they see. I'd like to stop here. Thy foe, God's enemy, the devil and his angels will rejoice when my sorrow they see. So I was thinking too, this is not our fight. This is not our battle. Our enemies are actually not our enemies. They're the enemies of God. And that's a key. Thy foes will rejoice when my sorrow they see. They're God's enemies, and God will see to that. Thy foes will rejoice when my sorrow they see and smile at the tears I have shed and rejoice in our suffering and our hurt. And then it says, he speaks, different verses here. He speaks and 10,000s of angels rejoice and myriads wait for his word. He speaks and eternity fills with his voice, re-echoes the praise of the Lord. And in closing, dear shepherd, I hear and will follow thy call. I know the sweet sound of thy voice. Restore and defend me, for thou art my all, and in thee will I ever, ever rejoice.